Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. This is Peter Bregan. I'm always so glad to be with you. Some of you have been asking after my wife, Ginger, who is doing very, very well. As some of you know, she had a very small stroke a few weeks ago. It was so slight that she didn't even want to go to the hospital. She didn't know what it was. She was just had a little lisp. And I said, we're on our way. If you're not moving your tongue exactly right all the time. And fortunately, they took us seriously at the hospital here in my hometown. And she did not get any worse. And they kept her overnight and everything checked out. CAT scan was normal except for the MRI, which did show a very small stroke of a few days old. That was a few days old. And now, a few weeks later, looking at her, you see nothing the matter with her. Her voice has returned to normal. She's doing great. And I just want everybody to know that. She's doing absolutely great. We just are closer than ever and spending more time than ever together and supporting each other more and more in our older years here. And she's really doing wonderfully well. The only adverse result that she's had, really, that's all lasting right now, is tiredness. She does get more tired. And since now at my age, I'm going to be 80 next birthday, next May 11th, I tend to get a little tired, too. We're still in sync, sleeping longer hours and enjoying each other's company. Now, remember that last week on Wednesday, I told you if you were listening that I had just spoken on Skype to a conference that I couldn't go to, and that was because of Ginger's injury, from which she is now just wonderfully recovered. And then I was planning to go to Copenhagen and to a marvelous conference in London and to give very long talks. Well, I did them both by Skype. And since I talked to you last, I did the London one. It went so well. I could see the audience. They were laughing at my jokes much more than the Danes. I'm not sure what that means. They were really getting what I was saying. They were applauding on and off. And I got feedback that it was just a marvelous event for everybody, including me. I felt very much like I was there. So I'm going to suggest to those of you who are my listeners that if you can find groups, it should be at least as large as a classroom for me to take a couple hours out of my day. But if you have some groups that can't afford to bring me in and I don't want to travel that much anymore, I will be happy if they don't have any money to do a two-hour presentation on my overview of everything from guilt, shame, and anxiety to the brain disabling effects of psychiatric drugs and psychiatric drug withdrawal. Be happy to give a couple of hours to you and talk with no charge at all. And then if you're a group that, you know, has some sort of a stipend, I'll take that happily. But I really want to put that out there. Skype works well. And I have the great microphone that I use for this show, and I have a high definition little camera. So keep that in mind, you know. I'd like 20 or 30 people for events like that, or hundreds. We have large audiences in Denmark and Britain. So I'm available to talk live on Skype to the right audiences without any charge, just to spread the word. Speaking of spreading the word, my guest today is a word spreader, the good words. Howie Glasser, how are you there?
I hear you there. Can you hear me?
Hi. I hear you loud and clear.
That's perfect. I love it.
How
I'm so glad to hear that Ginger's well and recovering.
Thank you.
Getting to spend more loving time together.
and slowing down together. Although I worked before the show, and my alarm went off to break into my work and tell me the show was coming up, I worked 5 straight hours on a legal case. And
my
so
goodness.
I'm still able to pour it on in the hard, hard work that requires.
I got to tell you something, Peter. The Children's Success Foundation may want to take you up on a Skype program, because the word from our participants when you came and did a workshop for us and a keynote was so strong. You got such great feedback, just so your viewers know. And we're thinking of creating a Nurtured Heart Training Institute Academy, where we would have things like this archived. And, you know, maybe we could even make it available for CEUs, in which case it would produce some income for you.
Well, I'm happy to do that. And I always
I would love to have the legacy of your brilliant work in our archive.
Well, that's
for
wonderful.
For all people.
That is wonderful. Well, who am I talking to, folks? Who is Howard Glasser, Glasser, who talks so warmly to me and I to him? Well, Howard is the Johnny Appleseed of loving children. He goes around the world, and this is a new metaphor, I think, for him. He goes around the world spreading the seeds of how to raise children, even the toughest kids, which he was, he says, how to raise these kids with love and attention that is entirely positive. Entirely positive. And it's called the Nurtured Heart Approach. It's, I think, the best single approach to begin with and to make the heart of your approach to children, the Nurtured Heart Approach. We're going to be talking to that. Howie runs the Children's Success Foundation in Tucson. That's where I gave my address that he said went so well, and just wonderful people. He does trainings. I don't know if he would mention that specifically, but you know, you can go get trained in the Nurtured Heart Approach and see Howie. And wonderful, wonderful people. I mean, you want to get together with a great group of people, hang around Howard Glasser. He talks internationally. He talks all around the place. He's got a number of books. And Howie, what's the updates on your latest book? I know eventually he's going to have one coming out that I have the introduction to.
Well, I think the latest you know about is the one I wrote using the approach on myself, and transparently describing how that process went. And that one's called Igniting Greatness. So that one's for adults who want to explore how it could go. And then I just came out with a book for kids, my first children's book called To Your Greatness. And it's I did it with my colleague Catherine Stafford, and she and I used to sign my emails to your greatness. And so she got moved by that and sent me what she thought was a good beginning and for what could be a kid's book. And then we got this beautiful heart art from a dear friend who is a museum quality painter. And the book is really great for kids to experience art as well, and it's just heartwarming to sit with a child and read this message to a child and tell them about their greatness. So that's the latest.
Well, I'm very, 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 very glad to hear you're doing that. Howie has also done something that very few people have been brave enough to do. in the midst of a very successful and growing career in the nurtured heart approach, Howie has repeatedly taken the risk of coming out against drugging children. And he's promoted my work consistently.
Mm-hmm.
This was an incredibly courageous act because people have been hounded nearly to death for doing those kinds of things. Howie, did you run into any trouble that you can measure? Sometimes it's trouble you can't measure.
You know, Peter, after our
work,
I got to tell you, I wrote that book a long time ago called 101 Reasons to Avoid Ritalin Like the Plague. That was around the time that there was a supersize me, movie, and I had one primary reason for writing the book, because I saw these kids go from using their intensity poorly to using their intensity in great ways. So it pained me to think that kids got put on medication and got the meta message that something the heck is wrong with them because of their intensity, their life force, that nobody could handle it. We need to make it go away. To me, was why I wrote that book. Probably 100 other reasons came from your work and my the inspiration I got from your work. After I finally met you years later, and hearing kind of how you got hounded, and I won't be specific, but it was frightening. I decided I didn't want to walk around with a bulletproof vest. It wasn't worth it. My way of changing the world will be to teach this approach, so it inspired me to teach at greater levels. And someday, my vision is that there'll be whole school districts that have no kids or low to no kids on medication. And then, you know, we'll just kind of wonder how that's going to go. You know, there won't be anybody to fight on that. It'll be larger than them, the pharmaceutical companies. Maybe the pharmaceutical companies will finally get some message that they need to, like renewable energy, that they got to, like, at least look at what's new and possible. And, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But that's in the works, because there are a lot of schools now that have taken this up, and sometimes the success of one school has inspired their whole district, and that's happening in quite a few cities now. So I am hopeful that one of these days I'll hear low to no meds in a whole school district. You'll be the first to know.
I've written, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you, Allie, I've mentioned it on the air, that I do have an article out in Children and Society, which is a peer-reviewed journal, in which I review the bad effects of the stimulant drugs and the antipsychotic drugs on children as two classes that exemplify the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And I call for professionals to start talking about a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children. And folks, if you're interested in distributing that idea to people, let's start talking about a ban on psychoactive substances. And you can stomach a very scientifically written article. Go to my website, and up at the top where it talks about my recent, adventures or accomplishments, as a list of five or six things, you'll get a direct link to this article. Howie, dive into, if you like, and if you want to dive into something else, dive into the nurtured heart approach.
Yeah. It came out of my work with difficult kids as a therapist, a family therapist. And I quickly found that the methods I studied in school weren't working for me. Are you still there, Peter?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I didn't like just doing therapy to collect a paycheck. I wanted to see results, and I actually believed I was seeing results go in the opposite direction. So we had a set of concerned parents who were miserable in relation to a child, and I found myself giving them advice that was probably very akin to what they were trying already, which probably frustrated them, and it was very clear and evident my advice was making it worse. And then, by way of being in the room with families and children of that nature, I started to remember my own career, so to speak, as a difficult kid, and I started to literally see the energy of interactions, and I started to see that merely trying to convince a child that they should do a better job, which is what we're known for in our society. You know, kids have, we give lectures in the midst of the problem. We interact with kids when the problems are happening. And some kids pick up the energetic impression that they're more valued and meaningful to the adults in their life when problems are happening, and they're literally or kind of invisible when problems aren't happening. You know, we say thank you and good job, and it's very low-key. When things go wrong, you know, we lie to kids. We're never too busy for a problem. We always show up, and we don't only show up, we show up in a juicy way. We lean in. And so some kids get pretty addicted to that, and my work, Nurtured Heart Approach, is about not only reversing that, but taking advantage of the intensity kids have and kind of riding the waves of aligned energy by using all the moments when things aren't going wrong, using all the moments when even little things are going right, and congratulating kids, appreciating them, sending them the message that here's you doing the right thing, and here's how you're doing the right thing. Here's the evidence. Here's these qualities I see in you that I'm admiring. Here's the beauty I see in you. I believe some kids, and tell me if you think this is meshes with your experience, Peter, I think some kids have the shades down, and they have a death grip on the shades, and they're not going to let anybody in until they feel seen profoundly. And, you know, your work is based on love, and I think that's why we're such fans of one another's work. And I think when kids equate being seen deeply with being loved, they start to let go, and they start to let people in, and they start to, you know, decide they're going to contribute and be a part of life again. And that's what I've seen.
You know, it's very, very consistent with Alfred Adler's work. And every year I go to the conference that the Florida Adlerians put on. In fact, folks, we have lined up a fabulous conference for next year, which I can just tell you if you want to go to Tampa, March 3rd through 5th, we're going to have a great conference down there with the Adlerians. Howard's been to some of those conferences.
Right. I'm not going to be able to make this year's, unfortunately, because of a scheduling conflict that came up. But I will be there the year after.
Well, anyhow, you can set aside March 3 through 5. It's going to be one of my very few appearances in public. And it's down in lovely Tampa with lovely people. But, you know, Adler talked about it's a great conference. And Adler talked about social interest, that children are motivated by social interest. I think we can call it empathy and love. And that the social interest gets thwarted and distorted, and then they try to get power. And this fits so much with Howie's approach, because Howie talks about how kids will try to get their energy satisfied or their attention satisfied in distorted ways if they're not getting it in good ways. Would you take off on that somehow?
I agree completely that there's a connection in the work, and I haven't studied or read Adler in a long time until last year when I went to that conference, and I was amazed at hearing all the connections. I think we all want to be loved, as you would say, as Adler would say. And I think when we have more life force within us, we have a more compelling sense and urgency to love and be loved. We want to be connected. We, in modern terms, you might say we want better broadband. We want more bandwidth. And some kids just simply discover inadvertently they get more bandwidth when things are going wrong, and low bandwidth, poor receptivity and connection when things go right. So that's the nature of my work, is giving people a perspective and some tools to turn that around. I'm sure if I examined Adlerian work closely, it would be just another way of explaining a very similar thing.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. We want to be loved and we want to love. We want to contribute. Children thrive on actually contributing.
Mm-hmm.
I know I made a mistake in raising my kids because I was under the influence of the 60s and I didn't ask them to contribute a lot. I figured they didn't ask to be born. I was just going to give them what they needed in life. And I don't think it's, I don't think it's the best way. I see the best way as really encouraging your children to contribute to the family, to contribute to society, to share your values in that regard. Does that fit with Nurture to Heart?
It does. Maybe the way of connecting the dots there is to say, the language of Nurtured Heart Approach, the language of the methodology, so to speak, is a different kind of confrontation. It's saying to a child, this is you being that contribution. Here's how you're contributing. It's not saying to a child, wouldn't it be nice if you came with me to the homeless shelter to do my volunteer work, it's not a pep talk kind of approach that might imply, well, you're not doing it. It's actualizing things by saying it's not a question of whether you can or can't. Here you are doing that quality now. Here's the way you're contributing. So, even with young kids, you could say, here's how you're contributing to our family today. You're eating your meal, so we don't have to fight over that. You're eating everything that mom served. You're eating nutritious food, so you're staying healthy. That's a way of contributing to the well-being of our family. You got a good night's sleep. That's a good way to contribute. And as kids grow older, obviously, we can define that even more. You contributed by being a great member of this world by going to school, getting there, doing your work, doing your main job of being a student and being a great kid in the home. That's a great way to contribute. We alter our eyes to, it's not even the cup half full or half empty. It's the cup could be completely empty, and it's our imagination that, we're only limited by our imagination of what we could say to kids. So we could, we're talking to, I bet a lot of families listening to this call have, hold respect and responsibility as very dear qualities. So Nurtured Heart would confront the child with their respectfulness. And, so during the, if respect is the biggest thing ever in your family, go up to your child and say, here's how you're being respectful right now. You're not rolling your eyes when I talk to you. You're not yelling. You're not arguing. Those are great ways to be respectful. You listen carefully. You did what I asked you to do. That's tremendous respect and responsibility. So they get a growing sense of, oh, I am that quality. And then they could live that quality better. That's been my experience, is that as kids drink in that they are that quality, then they get comfortable with it.
Now, you have films, videos. How do people get a hold of those?
excuse me. I think if you were to go to ChildrenSuccessFoundation.com, you would find your way to quite a few videos. There's a free e-course that explains the basic tenets of the approach.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
It's a great little e-course. There's, you know, the nutshell is it's, you know, you get three different 4-minute videos sent to you, and each one covers a stand, so to speak, of the approach. You know, the first one is, you know, I refuse to do things, you know, be the old normal traditional way of giving energy to negativity. I'm not going to do that. Second stand is, here's what I am going to do. I'm going to make it my mission to see the beauty in what you're doing and respond to that, express my appreciation for all the things I see you doing in the right direction, all the things I see that you're not doing wrong. And the third stand is, here's what I'm going to hold you accountable for, but in a very surprisingly simple, easy way. You know, I like accountability that's easy for everybody. But where a child really, truly has a sense that they've been held accountable.
Folks, we're talking with Howie Glasser, G-L-A-S-S-E-R. He teaches the Nurtured Heart Approach. And this approach is not just for parents, it's for professionals. I have some friends, mutual friends, whom Howie has trained in this approach, who bring it right into their therapy work. Could you talk about that, Howie? Is there a difference that's worth discussing between how you sit with parents and explain things to them as a therapist, or how parents might learn in a workshop, or just talk about
these parameters? Yeah, I could talk a little bit. You know, answering your question, Peter. I do a fair amount of traveling where I do one-day seminars. I've just recently encouraged the Children's Success Foundation to take up the cause of sponsoring seminars. So someday we hope to have seminars all over the country on a regular basis. We also have an online version of that seminar at the foundation on the training page. It's very affordable, and it's a 24/7 course. We also have a longer version, a very, very beautifully designed course that has interaction with me. That's coming up soon. That's on that Children's Success Foundation page. The other thing that I do that I love most of all is I train trainers. So, you know, on any given day, there are dozens, maybe dozens, of classes. At least every given week, there are dozens of classes going on around the world because people came and did a certification training with me, which then allowed them, kind of gave them the legitimacy to go out and teach it in a full-blown way. You know, therapists can read a book or take my online course, and they could go use it in their practice, and some do. It really just takes it to a different place, though, when they take the in-depth training. While we're talking, I'm going to grab some water.
If you want to take a minute or two break to take care of yourself, I can
I got water in my hand, so just if you queue up another question, I'll be fine.
Well, let me just talk a minute. I'll think of something to say. Sometimes when I get into a difficult situation in therapy, I will remember Howie. I will think of Howie.
and I will change what I'm doing from being oriented around insight or to confronting somebody about their destructive behavior, and I will just take a deep breath and I'll address the good things about this person.
And how does that work down?
Oh, it works fine. It works absolutely fine. Now, I don't have a controlled clinical trial, but, I mean, you've actually influenced just the way I think about things, you know, hanging around and listening to you talk and meeting your folks, because I do think that the positive works better just about every time. And
you know, I think it's in our DNA. And I know you, you're the scientist, so you tell me if you think this holds merit. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, we all know we wouldn't be here if not for our ancestors who had once upon a time to survive, you know, dangers, predators. You know, for them to survive, they had to sense danger. They had to see just tiny increments of it. They had to smell in a more profound way. And I think any of us, even if we think we're positive, we could go into a child's room that's pretty neat and tidy, and we could see dozens of things that should have been done better or could be done in the future. Our eyes just spot that stuff in a flash, and we could wax poetically about what's wrong. That also is in our bloodstream, and I think we have to fight it. You know, so you know, by way of my early training as a psychologist, you know, pretty much every method that came my way had an element of, you know, insight. Insight is based on seeing what's wrong, and explaining it to people. Well, if I have somebody in my office who has this inner energetic of believing they get better, juicier relationship through what's wrong, you know, which, you know, I'd say the vast number of human beings do, then by merely talking to them about what's wrong, even my heartfelt, loving attempts to explain what's wrong might well deepen their impression. As opposed to what you did beautifully, I applaud you. You reset yourself, and you decided, well, I'm going to change the flow of energy here. I'm going to talk to them about what's right in the midst of everything they might think is a crisis. I'm going to talk to them about what parts of their thinking are constructive. I'm going to talk to them about the aspects of their character that I see as constructive and upbeat. Let me confront them with that. So beautiful, Peter. Beautiful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, Howie. I had an interesting email conversation. I'm a member of the Critical Psychiatry Network, which is based in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to email, group email, about issues. And people were discussing my paper and my book on guilt, shame, and anxiety.
How's that going, that book? Tell me what came up.
It's doing better than, I would say, my other books. Not a bestseller. Haven't had one of those in a few years, but it's doing well. And I'm going to be building on it in some interesting ways for my next book, which is at this point still a closely held secret to my heart because it's so different than anything else I've done. But the themes of the book are that guilt, shame, and anxiety are biological endowments to control our violence and our anger and our willfulness and our personal relationships, so that when we have conflict in personal relationships, we're very susceptible from infancy on to feel guilt, shame, and anxiety, which is inhibitory. That's kind of it. And then that we can, the second part is that we can overcome this and push aside, identify, not respond to guilt, shame, and anxiety, and live by reason, love, and ethics and love. Well,
the response from a lot of the mental health people has been a bit lukewarm. And today or yesterday, I mean, one of them actually came around, a couple of them said, we need guilt, shame, and anxiety. And today, someone said, well, you know, and quoted me about very exactly about rejecting guilt, shame, and anxiety and living by reason and love. And this person said, isn't it the definition of a psychopath that you don't have guilt, shame, and anxiety?
Well, that's a boatload right there.
So, and I think this is really relevant to people understanding your work. And I wrote back that
I guess I'm a psychopath too. I'm in good company.
Well, that's right. You know, that's the implication, is that because you certainly don't believe in encouraging anybody's guilt, shame, or anxiety. I mean, these people are encouraging their patients and clients to feel guilt, shame, and anxiety. So I wrote back that...
Can I put that on my resume, and along with being delusional?
And having independent thought disorder? There's so many problems. Let me get this thought out.
I need medication for that, Peter.
Let me get this thought out. So I wrote back that actually the people we label psychopaths and who abuse others, use other people, and even kill other people seemingly for their own needs and without remorse, that these people, for one thing, are always deeply embedded in shame. They were shamed almost invariably so badly as children that they can't feel empathy toward other human beings. They feel fear and anger and resentment. Secondly, that they in fact often feel a great deal of guilt, not toward the people that they're messing with, but toward the parents who abused them, so that if you so much as made a bad remark about one of their mothers, they would gladly kill you and feel no more remorse. So they feel guilt toward their abusers, and they often have huge anxiety about human relationships. And don't connect to people, and that what is really lacking in those folks is empathy and love, being able to, in a positive, caring way, put themselves in the shoes of others, and that all the great thinkers, I believe, from the early Hebrew Bible, even more so into Christian Bible, through Albert Schweitzer and even Darwin and on up through my heroes like Gandhi, they've all said it's about love, it's not about hate, it's not about anger, and therefore, I think, not about guilt, shame, and anxiety. Take a breath. What do you think, sir?
Well, I it just dawned on me that I'm among, I'm squarely in that world with you, that I admire the same people, and that's quite a great summary. I think you have a lot more experience working with adults who have grown up through that, endured that kind of childhood and that kind of upbringing. I have found that kids who are on the beginning journey of uploading the sense of themselves that's disparaging, that can go on to accumulate enough to bring them into danger of doing harm to themselves or others, so to speak. I think when you can show them evidentially, here you are being empathetic. Here's how, you may not realize it, but and if we could show them we're appreciative of that, and that we could show them that we're admiring that quality in them, and we could really, even if they look at us funny and they don't even believe it at first, if we could look at them and go back in and say, well, let me give you more evidence. And we could use our dissection, our therapy dissection skills and our insight skills to dial in. Here's exactly what I'm talking about. And that's why I'm seeing that great quality in you, that, you know, we could call it thoughtfulness, We could call it compassion. We could call it empathy. But that's essentially what you're doing. And in a way, we're confronting that person with the truth of how this other human being is drinking in, you know, impressions of their life. And I have found that when I, to the level I need to, as relentlessly as I need to, when I've taken that course of action, that kids, at some point, it's almost like release a muscle, and they go, oh, that is me. That is me. They start forming a new portfolio, so to speak, of who they think they are. You know, they've been going on an old portfolio of who they thought they were, and they need to get introduced to who they really are. And I find that as I gain ground in that adventure, and I rely heavily on the adults in a child's life who has much more access than 1 hour a week, you know, who have multiple hours a day with this child, the teachers and the parents. I've found that's where we really gain ground, by making them into the therapist. But that's my opinion on it, is that it's remediable. And
very
love
good.
Is the
very
answer.
Eloquent. Yet love is the answer. Not original, but hard to do. And Howie Glasser, my friend, does a marvelous job applying it to how to relate to children. Howie, talk about how you've gone about changing school districts. How does somebody do that? I've never changed a school district.
Well, you know, it's not by way of me approaching a school ever. That's not my style. Maybe someday we'll have somebody on our foundation team who has that wildly amazing skill. The way it's happened is that we have schools that are currently suffering, for lack of a better term. Here's what schools do, in my humble opinion. They do this strange mathematical thing of playing the odds, playing the percentages. So they have 90% of kids who are seemingly fine and dandy, and they have 10% of the kids who are challenging by way of their intensity. And they pick again and again and again school-wide policies and approaches that serve the 90%. Well, then the 10% eat them for lunch and spit them out, and they're contagious because they infect the other kids too, in a way that's damaging to education of all. And you know, the difference is that when an educator, when a teacher or a principal come to study Nurture Heart and the light bulbs go off and they go, oh, this is the different other way around. This serves the 10% of kids primarily. This turns these kids around, and it just happens to have a very positive effect on the other kids too. Then you have a different set of outcomes. So that the way I've got to school districts is by luck, is that there have been enough people over the years who have decided that they weren't going to wait. They were going to go find something, search for something that's different. They found their way to my work. They brought it to their school. And some of them went on to influence people in a big way, their communities. And, you know, there are now Nurture Heart Approach trainers who are making their careers as consultants and teaching this to in bigger platforms. So I'm just in awe. And it wasn't me, Peter. It was some miracle.
Howie, the people you trained, do you have any requirements? Do they have to have gone to Harvard and gotten a PhD in psychology?
No, actually, it's very organic and grassroots. So for me, what I want, and somebody who's going to go to that level of training, the certification intensive, is I want somebody who has has read a book and taken a course. It could be one book, and it could be an online course, but I also require that the person has tried it out in their life, has lived with it, has explored its impact and its efficacy for them. And so I want people who show up for an intensive to have that starting point and to really want to dive deeper and really want to learn the approach. So that could be somebody with fancy degrees, even an MD from Harvard. It could be somebody who has no degrees. It could be a parent. We've had some very, powerfully influential people in my world who started out as a parent and struck by how the impact they had on their own child, and then from there decided they were going to move it out into the community, and that's just fine. I mean, they're only limited by, the legalities of their world. They can't then, start a therapy practice unless they get the proper licensing or degrees, but they can march out into their community and teach a parenting class, or they could do other things. So, and alongside that, there are, probably hundreds of people with who've taken this training who have PhDs and other such degrees, like a licensed social worker and marriage and family counselor and et cetera, psychologist.
So theoretically, this is wonderful, by the way. Theoretically, a person could get this training, learn how to do the nurtured heart approach with children and adults,
mm-hmm.
and just set up a practice and make a living if they could get people to come, as long as they didn't call themselves something that was licensed. So
exactly.
They could be a nurtured
heart trainer
if they want.
Yeah, we leave it to them to deal with the illegalities, and we require that they respect the legalities of their discipline. But they can truly go out in their world and teach others, and is depending on how convincing they are, they could get people showing up.
Do some people earn a living as independent
therapists? I'm going to take a wild guess,
like,
but I'd say there are hundreds of people at this point who are making their careers based on this primarily.
That's wonderful. You know, I didn't realize till our conversation today on the radio how much this fits the model that I have always wanted to try implementing, but have not been successful in getting any institution or to do it, and I don't have the energy to do it myself, which is to actually set up training institutes where people with or without degrees
mm-hmm.
could come and learn to do therapy. And that therapy could become so available if we didn't, and so
to do, whatever you would call your therapy. Mm-hmm. I know it's had different reference points over the years. Empathic therapy may be the latest. Forgive me for not knowing exactly what it is, but if you had the empathic therapy institute or academy, and you were teaching a coursework that was sized to a digestible form where somebody could come study essentially a basic frame of that in a week, if they went out into their treatment practice and they were then keeping people off medications, that would essentially really serve that cause, wouldn't it? I hope I'm doing that from an early childhood point of view. I hope that's exactly what I'm doing, is I'm serving to enhance people's lives, parents and teachers and children, but I'm also have that secondary outcome of eliminating the need for diagnosis and medications.
Yes, it's exactly what I'm thinking of.
I just had the right people come along. I mean, I didn't necessarily see that specific technique. You know, I kind of stumbled into doing that. Let's say so many of the things I've done have been quite incidental and accidental, but I'm very excited that that's what we not only do now, but we're doing in a very organized, a much more organized way through the Children's Success Foundation.
Let me clear up the idea of empathic therapy. It's very confusing. When I talk about the Empathic Therapy Center, which is our 501c3, we sponsor conferences and use that language. I'm talking about an umbrella for any therapy that is drug-free and tries to help people in a caring model, respectful model, treasuring model. And you fit that perfectly. I have an empathic therapy training film, which actually sells quite well, but it's basically, as I say, it's about my method of approaching therapy, and I just want people to watch it to get encouragement to find their own method. What you have done is something I've never tried to do. It's just not my nature, which is to find a particular way that you could program and describe and present in a very simple form and usable form a therapeutic approach.
Right.
And I think that, I'm sorry?
Oh, I was just nodding my head because we've had a couple of people along the way in our organization who, you know, kind of pointed me in the direction of seeing that more clearly, that we could orchestrate that more, that it indeed is a methodology. I've called it an approach. It's always been a philosophy and practice, a methodology, but I didn't necessarily, you know, so I thought I was the only person who could train this. You know, I didn't want to give away my 10,000 hours. But I got convinced at a certain point that it made sense, if nothing else other than a legacy, to take, you know, the PowerPoints and the keynotes presentations and package them, you know, so other people could have that very same framework and go out and teach this in their communities to their organizations. And, you know, I'm very thankful for that. I never would have done that on my own. And so now we have, you know, certified trainers now have access to all of that, to a very vast library of videos that they could use for their presentations and all these teaching modules, which are wonderful and so well done, books on, you know, kind of guidebooks on how to go about doing these trainings. So I'm amazed at how many people have actually taken that and run with it in one way or another. So that's the part that I never would have done on my own, Peter. So we're alike in that way. You know, it's just people coming along. You know, I've had the Children's Success Foundation for 20 years, but it was only in 2011 that I decided I was going to do a series of public seminars for the purpose of funding it and getting, you know, actually hiring people and not even knowing exactly what I was, you know, what I was going to find myself into, what was going to come of that. And it turned out that people had different skills and different visions and kind of lit up some runways along those lines.
Talk a little more about this issue that fascinates me, which is how you go into a school district. You talked about how they come to you, but what happens in some of the school districts, maybe pick the one you've been most successful in, where you actually end up changing things? Can you give some details on that?
Yeah,
there
are a few school districts. I don't know if it's district-wide yet, some seem to be on their way to district-wide, but there's a number of little constellations of schools up in Northern California and up in Fargo, Moorhead area, West Fargo, that have percolated in this. And I'm not actually the person teaching there. You know, I've taught in both communities over the years a few times, but there's groupings of trainers. There's, you know, people inspire other people, and they inspire other people. And there's probably 100 trainers or more from each of those areas who are out there, you know, either working right in a school or working alongside a school in some consultancy format, and then along comes an administrator who gets inspired to come to a training, you know, like a superintendent of schools or somebody of that nature, who decides, oh, I want a certified trainer in every single school. And so, or I want 2 certified trainers in every single school. So they create their vision, and then it's up to that person. You know, so let's say I'm John Doe, and I've been hired to take this training and bring it to one of the schools in a district. I then do not only training there, but I do coaching. So along with the model I have, we now have a very nice coaching model that's very supportive to those learning the approach. So it's not a critical model, it's a loving model. You know, it's just always purposely starts with what, you know, where are you, what are you doing right, complimenting that person every step of the way, and then kind of holding their hand and walking down the road with them as they get their sense on how to bring the use of the approach up to the level of the kids in their room. It's been very exciting to watch, and then a lot of you know, the great thing about schools is they have an impact in the community.
Yeah.
A bunch of schools have ongoing parent class.
We're getting near closing here. I have to finish up. We're under a minute. Folks, I just want to tell you again, this is Howard Glasser, Howie Glasser, G-L-A-S-S-E-R. It's the Nurtured Heart Approach. I can't think of anything that could harm you by taking his training. I've sat in on some of it. And I can think of so many ways that it can enhance your life as a parent, a therapist, a general good person. Howie, thanks a lot for being on the show again.
Thank you so much, Peter. You're the best.
Thank you, Howie. So are you.
Thank you.